ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Corbin Middlemass. Have you got Ashes fever? Well, we've got the perfect podcast for you. It's called ABC Cricket Podcast. I'm joined by former Australia opener Ed Cowan every Monday and Friday, as well as after every day of Test cricket all summer long. The Australia-England rivalry has never been bigger, so make sure you're across every angle. This is the best analysis and insights on the game, and it's coming your way. Search for ABC Cricket Podcast on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
To Big Ideas, I'm Natasha Mitchell, and this is the show where we bring you big thinkers at the best live events. Today on the program, spirituality, religion. What have they got to do with your mental health?
Religious affiliation is significantly associated with higher positive mental health. Organized religious activities are associated with lower anxiety symptoms. And faith in God and spirituality are named as important contributors to recovery in serious mental illness.
Psychiatrist Dr. Daniel Fung, CEO of the Institute of Mental Health in Singapore and president of the College of Psychiatrists with the Academy of Medicine Singapore. Now, this suggestion that spirituality or religious faith has a role in our mental health or in our recovery from mental illness has long been controversial. Studies have often been poorly designed or inconclusive. It does raise interesting questions though, doesn't it? Because does religion provide a sense of purpose, of meaning, of community in a way that helps our mental health? Or are the specifics of a faith also key? The belief in a higher power? Daniel Fung is adjunct associate professor at all three Singapore medical schools. He's past president of the International Association for Child and Adolescent Psychiatry and Allied Professions. He's also author of 35 books, and he gave this keynote address at the 2025 Mental Health Services Conference in Brisbane, exploring mind, body, and soul.
So let me start with some disclosures. I am a Christian, and I am focused on working beyond the medical field. I think a lot of what we do as a physician sometimes restricts us in what we can accomplish as human beings. So you must be wondering why I chose the topic, Loving Hearts, Beautiful Minds. This actually is a tagline of our hospital, and I like that. I have a mind, like all of you, and I have a heart. My mind represents, I would say, my brain to some degree, and the heart is part of my body. So my mind and my body, they work together. But there's something else about me that cannot be explained today, perhaps. Or maybe it can be. Let me start by talking about the concept of an ecosystem. What is an ecosystem? It's a bunch of living things, like me, sitting perhaps in a beautiful forest with trees and mountains in the background. So this is an ecosystem, living things in an environment. Now, when we talk about mental health ecosystems, a little bit more sophisticated, or maybe not. I'd like to think that there is a concept that a social scientist once described, the river of life. His name is Antonovsky, and in the 70s, he talks about the river of life. And he talks about health in the river of life. So upstream in the river, where the source of the river, I don't know whether you are familiar with rivers, but I'm sure you are, because Singapore only has one river and it's really small. And rivers have a source. Very often, it's in the mountains or in higher places. It could be on the ground as well, from a spring. In fact, every time I think of river of life, I think of the Nile, you know, in Egypt. But the Nile actually doesn't originate from Egypt. It originates from a couple countries away. So rivers of life are quite interesting and intricate, and they're part of a normal ecosystem. But imagine a health ecosystem, where the source of the river, where it's safe, where life exists, very often is not where healthcare facilities and services lie. They lie at the base or downstream in the river. Now, in Antonovsky's metaphor, upstream is where good health exists. And downstream is where crisis, death, exists. And most healthcare facilities work in that space. So like our hospital, I have a 2,000-bedded hospital in Singapore. We represent 90% of the psychiatric beds. And we are right at the base of the river. We save lives at the very brink of death, suicide, or other serious mental illness. And we've been doing it for almost 100 years, from the time of asylum to today. And we always wonder, as a psychiatrist, why do I have to see people when they're sick? Let me now talk about the concepts around health or mental health ecosystem. Firstly, what are the dimensions of mental health? There are three. The first one, that's mental sickness. Mental sickness is how populations and societies view mental illness and mental health in general. It's linked to stigma. There are only two stigmatizing conditions in health. One of them is infectious disease, and the other is mental illness. Then we have mental health and mental illness. Mental health is related to what I would call stress. Most of us have mental health issues because we are stressed in a bad way. There is good stress, there's tolerable stress, and then there's toxic stress. I'll get to that in a moment. Then there's mental illness. Mental illness is the experience of a disorder of the brain. Mental illnesses are neural network problems, which means that today we have no clear way of investigating this with the science that we have. The closest we have is neuroimaging, functional imaging, but we do not understand how neural networks work. The decade of the brain, by the way, was declared by President Obama in the 90s. He said, this is the decade of the brain. The neurologists celebrated in being understanding, better understanding of brains. But as psychiatrists, I say that the brain is still quite a mystery organ. According to the WHO, 1 in 8 persons have a mental illness in their lifetime. That's the risk. I think in Australia, it's 1 in 5. In Singapore, it's 1 in 7, based on our last epidemiological survey. But the figure appears to be rising. That's important to be aware of. Mental disease and mental illness, I put it as different sides of the same coin. Mental sickness, as I've said, is really society's view of illness and disease. And mental health is actually a very broad concept, not just illness-based, but really about well-being. And that's in the latest WHO report, which talks about 4 things: connecting with people, functioning in life, coping, and thriving. So wellness is a very broad concept, and well-being is not just absence of illness. And that's mental health. That's the job that I've been asked, or all of us have been asked to look after. It's very broad. But the problem with this is that very often we are isolated from the rest of health. Our systems are isolated. We have 2 ecosystems, the health ecosystem and the mental health ecosystem, and they're not really talking to one another enough. I mean, I have a 2,000-bedded hospital made up of psychiatrists, psychologists, psychiatric nurses, social workers, other allied health, mental health professionals. I have very few physicians who look after the body. We've been trying to build that up, but it's really small. The body is equally important, because the mind doesn't exist in isolation from the body. And the body certainly cannot be isolated from the mind. And there is this connection. It's dynamic and interactive. And then there's going to be a 3rd thing that I want to talk about. Let's start with the body. The physicians say that persistent physical symptoms is one of the greatest, and this is in Europe, one of the major problems that physical health is struggling with. And a lot of this has to do with mental health. I'll give you an example from the 60s. In Singapore, this was the news. Parents were very worried that their male child's penises were shrinking into their abdomen. It was a hysterical epidemic. The government had to come up and say, do not fear Koro. And it was reported, you know, in various articles. These are culture-bound syndromes that are hysteria-based. And one person telling another, there's something happening to their body, but it's psychological. So here's the mind interacting with the body. Then we have a curious situation of alexithymia and alexithymia in psychiatry. Why I say it's curious is because very often we talk of this as though it's purely psychological symptom, but there are, and this is a scientist in Japan who has studied the brains of these individuals and found that this disconnect is actually related to how the brain functions. The mind and the body are connected. Psychological and physiological functions don't exist in isolation. For example, if you're stressed, your blood pressure will go up, your immune system will come down. You may have inflammatory and pain responses in different ways. You might be more sensitive to pain, especially if you're depressed. If you're anxious, you might have gastrointestinal issues and your heart might beat very fast. If you're not thinking very clearly, it could be related to nutritional deficiencies. And I've often seen this. When I have a young person or an older person who tells me they can't think clearly, I do a blood test and I find that the blood counts are low. There are hormonal changes. Thyroid illness, for example, has lots of mimics to mental health conditions. The mind and body cannot be disconnected. There is an ecosystem that is linked. In fact, this is what we would call a mind or brain-body loop. So this loop is quite interesting. I don't know whether you've noticed it. Your body has ways of dealing with things on the ground which you don't notice in your brain. Sometimes you turn around, hey, why? I've got a bruise here. I've got a cut that is starting to heal. I didn't remember cutting myself or hitting myself. It's because you have an internal reflexic system that's healing you on the spot that your brain is not directly informed of. These loops exist and they're important. Are not just nervous system loops. There's loops around chemical messengers in your body. So it's important to remember that they are all linked. Then what about this issue of stress? Hans Selye was the first person who described stress. He was Hungarian, and I guess if he was Australian or some Englishman, the name would not be called stress, because I think he borrowed from engineering and his English wasn't very good. But interestingly, a lot of the things that we talk about are borrowed from engineering terms. When he talked about stress, today we understand stress in a more varied way, and perhaps this is too complicated. But stress affects not only individual systems in the rest of your body, but also your brain. Good stress motivates you, pushes you, makes you do a lot of things. It can be tolerable, like when you have to, you know, make a presentation and you're in front of a lot of people and you're given labels like the best dress. That's very stressful to me. Should tear off my tie now. And then there's toxic stress. Stress that is uncontrollable, persistent, chronic, that has what we would call an allostatic load onto the body that continues to be a burden over time and accumulates. That results in vulnerability. Good stress is resilient. So stress is not a bad thing per se, but it's an important thing to consider. And by the way, stress is very personal. What is toxic to one person may not necessarily be toxic to somebody else. It's not something that we can measure easily either, even with the chemical messengers that we talk about. Nobody's really been able to put a pin on it. And probably that's why I think the term itself is not probably correct. But I don't have a better term for it. You know, whether you want to think of it as a brain neurotrophic factor or something else. Well, let's look at allostatic load. In Singapore, we did a study. And this is a cohort called the Growing Up Towards Healthy Outcomes cohort. And 526 children were followed up for 13 years. They're now about 14 years old. They were recruited at birth through the pregnant mothers. It's a very interesting cohort because we could study both physical and mental health conditions over time. And what's interesting is that adversity doesn't affect all the children. That means they don't necessarily have vulnerabilities unless they have certain other characteristics. And this is interesting because it's suggesting that certain groups of people are more vulnerable to stress or adversity under if they had a certain genetic disposition. So in this case, they found that children who had empathic concern actually are more likely to have bad outcomes if they're under a lot of adversity. And you don't see that in all kids. And they've studied this over time. There is two different groups. I think a similar study would be what Caspi has done amongst the victims of child abuse in Romania. There were certain groups that were more likely to become antisocial if they were exposed to adverse childhood experiences. And allostatic loads, the concept that one has to bear in mind, some of the children at birth and over time in their youth, as they grow older, if they are put under toxic stress, will have bad outcomes, and others will be very resilient because they don't have the same reaction. So the role of stress in disorders is interesting. A lot of times we assume that stress makes disorders appear worse. It is true if it appears at the right time. If it's a mediator, the stressor actually makes the stress result in some difficulties. But if it's later in life, where it's less pertinent, I think it is only a moderator. So this is an important consideration. Childhood is an important point in time where that vulnerability exists. And we have to pay attention to children, and we need to be aware of adverse childhood experiences. And stress isn't bad across lifespan. It's worse in childhood, particularly toxic stress.
Psychiatrist and researcher Dr. Daniel Fung from Singapore, speaking on spirituality and mental health care. My name is Natasha Mitchell, bringing you Big Ideas, ABC Radio National's live event show. You can find us on the ABC Listen app as well. And today, coming to you from the 2025 Mental Health Services Conference in Mianjin, Brisbane.
So let's talk about this now a little further. We know that there are chronic conditions which are being treated by physicians, physical health specialists, things like somatic symptom disorders, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, very often with psychiatric interventions, psychiatric medications. Then there's this question about mental health and lifestyle. You know, we were having this conversation earlier this morning about drinking coffee. Is it good for you? Is it bad for you? There are studies earlier on that were concerns about cancer. But on the other hand, I've looked at the data. It actually is pretty good for your health for a number of reasons. But if you over-caffeinate yourself, that might not be a good thing. You might be bouncing off the walls. And so therefore, lifestyle and mental health is important and related. But is there a third dimension? And I want to talk about this beyond the mind and body. What is there? What is different about us, human beings? I think we have a spirit. That's different. And Harold Koenig is a psychiatrist in Harvard in Boston. This is his definition of spirituality, the personal quest for understanding answers to ultimate questions about life, about meaning, and about relationship to the sacred or transcendent, which may or may not lead or arise from the development of religious rituals and the formation of community. Spirituality has been often missed in healthcare, partly because we say, well, it's not scientific, but perhaps what we need to do is to understand it more and perhaps also apply the same rigorous research that we do with other aspects, what I call the social determinants of health. So let's try and understand spirituality over time. Religion used to be the source of spirituality, linked to the practice of religion or religiosity. And religiosity and spirituality were used interchangeably. They have same meaning. And religion was the source of moral values. Of course, over time, secularism arose. In fact, I remember as a medical student, I've been told, please do not speak of religion in the hospital. You're not allowed to. We are a secular organization. And that's quite a problem because a lot of people carry with them spirituality that they bring from their homes. Then we have mental health. In fact, I met a pastor recently and says, oh, you are the equivalent, he said to me. We are of the same profession. You are the equivalent of me today. You're the modern pastor or priest. And I thought about it. He might have some truth. Because in mental health, we talk about meaning, we talk about purpose, about connectedness. Gosh, we are very spiritual. in our approach. We talk about peace, about hope. Antonovsky, that social scientist who talked about the origins of health. And he talks about sense of coherence, which is about meaning and purpose as leading to health. And health has a lot of assets, many of which are not health-related. It's not about the body, maybe something about the mind, but about a lot of other things, gratitude, reasonableness. In Singapore, we studied this a fair bit, but this is all done by the social scientists, not by the mental health professionals per se. Then there's mental illness. How is it linked to spirituality today? And then there's physical health. We talk about stress, infection, immunology, cardiovascular disease, cancer, mortality. A bunch of physicians in California got together and talked about adverse childhood experiences because they wanted to know why people were getting addictions and cardiovascular disease later in life. They wanted to look at social determinants up front. And actually, in terms of spirituality, what's happened is spirituality has grown bigger, you know, in the modern understanding, beyond religion. But it's still kind of outside of secularity. So a lot of secular systems will not speak of spirituality. But it's intersecting into health, very much so. Spirituality now covers a lot of areas. And perhaps it's important to think of spirituality. Let me give you an example. Suicide. Lots of studies that suggest that if you have a spiritual perspective, it would reduce suicides. Because having meaning and purpose will help. A couple of local studies in Singapore looked at religiosity, which is a subset of spirituality today, right? Religious affiliation is significantly associated with higher positive mental health. Organized religious activities are associated with lower anxiety symptoms. And faith in God and spirituality are named as important contributors to recovery in serious mental illness. This is purely religious, and we have seen that this actually works better. We have a religious room in the hospital. Any religion can come. I've tried to be, to go beyond saying no religious practices because I've said, look, if it's helpful for the family, please allow it. But no proselytizing, no trying to convert people, but please allow them to bring their own religion to practice. And it moderates stigma and the quality of life, right? I will talk about this and you can look at the literature. There is evidence here. So let's look at religion and spirituality in Asia. Asia and perhaps Oceania, I like to think that we have a lot of religions and we are highly religious compared to Europe. And looking at some of the religions in terms of growth, right? People who desire to grow spiritually. Christians in Europe, very low. But look at the rest of the world. In all the major religions other than Jewish, there is a desire to grow spiritually. This is a very recent study by the Institute of Policy Studies in Singapore. And religion is growing in importance. Singapore, a modern city-state, people were getting more religious. But what was interesting in this study is that it's different. The religion is less about gathering as a group, but more about personally discovering, going online. Actually, I personally attend church now online ever since the COVID. And I've been able to attend many churches, which I never did. I could listen to the Pope, anyone with any denomination. Gives me a lot of scope. And that's what's happening in Singapore. People are getting more information. And why? There's this desire to grow spiritually because it provides meaning and purpose. And so is it possible that we have a framework for spirituality in health? This is a case study. I put it down as a case study because in Indonesia, they actually have documents that talk about spirituality. Because when I gave this talk in Europe, I was told it's quite sticky. You know, you can't have the word spirituality or religion in any of our documents. But in Indonesia, it is part of their health framework. Doing my profession is also part of worship. I can't and wouldn't separate these two things. And a number of studies in West Java and other parts of Indonesia during the pandemic actually suggested that the interfacing of traditional religious and cultural explanations help in the treatments of mental illness and reduce mental health conditions. So it is possible to have a spiritual framework where beliefs, practices, and experience allow this connection. And if you take spirituality in the broader sense, right, apart from traditional religions, there's also nature, art. You know, the country that is the happiest in the world, is that Finland? They're tree huggers, you know. They hug trees, right? They believe in nature. It gives them a sense of fulfillment. I mean, I've got good friends who are Finn, and, you know, they have a different way of looking at things. But it's spiritual. Instead of not talking about it, we should start studying this and its impact on individuals. Now let's switch completely from the spiritual to the digital. Digital mental health ecosystems have been developing over the last 20 years. In the last 5 to 10, it's really sped up a lot. And it's because we're kind of getting ready. In Asia in particular, I think there's high digital adoption, a lot of digital growth around youths. And because mental health needs are so massive and the number of professional workers are so few, it was a need to sort of leverage on digital platforms for help. And digital allows overcoming a lot of barriers like waiting times and accessibility issues. So in Asia, this is in ASEAN actually, it's ready. And the penetration, digital penetration, it's pretty high. We have more handphones, right? Cell phones than people. It means that people have access to digital. A study we did in Singapore on our youth. Youth trust healthcare more than they trust social media. So if you provide the digital intervention through healthcare, you're going to get better buy-in for the young people. Now, I'm going to pivot into social media largely because that's a major concern these days. And if you want to be popular, social media is the place for you. Okay, so for popular people, not necessarily well-dressed, but popular people, got to be on social media. All right, this is a study that certainly suggests that. Social media has also been used as an intervention for mental health conditions, but largely around education and sometimes recruitment and research. The other thing about social media is that, well, in of itself, it's probably harmless, but if parents use a lot of social media, a lot of times when parents use social media and screen time, it actually interferes with family communication, and children will then have problematic media use. So is social media good or bad? I've shown you various functions that social media has. It's created a moral panic, I think, because we think it's bad. Now, I lived through the fears of television, computers, in creating moral panic. People were worried that television would be addictive and it would destroy society when it first came out in the 60s. The computer addiction was a huge issue, particularly gaming and video game violence. Again, not entirely proven that it is as bad as that. So is social media bad for your mental health? There is a number of studies that suggest that if you overuse it, it's associated with poor mental health. But we're not sure, is it the cause or effect? Do people with mental health conditions or stress get onto social media more? Actually, the overall conclusion of social media and mental health is likely that there is a very small relationship. But I know that it's created a huge thing because here in Australia and in parts of the world, they've all responded to Jonathan Haidt's book, The Anxious Generation. I remember I was walking down a meeting in the Ministry of Education, and one of the Director General of Education said, "Have you read this book?" You know, and there was a lot of concerns. But the studies that are described by Jonathan Haidt, I believe he's Australian, right? Are association studies. They're not causal. They're not longitudinal. But I want to talk about the third thing that concerns me, which is how does all of this digital and social media, I see it as part of a digital mental health piece, works in our ecosystem. So the STEP Care model is kind of a global best practice if you can implement it. Many countries have described it across the world. What we've not been able to do is to do it countrywide. to have an ecosystem. And actually, if you do the step care model well, you can do it globally. That means every step of the way, you have different tiers of help. So in Singapore, we call it the tiered care model. It's under the Agency for Integrated Care. At the base of that tier is the community, the population, where most people don't have a mental illness, but they need to be aware, right? Whether they are ACE aware, whether they are trauma-informed aware, know how to manage stress, understand the digital world and social media's impact. And then you move up the tiers as you need services. In Singapore, we have different care across these levels. We call them tiers 1 to 4. Four is the 3 and 4 are the sort of mental health professional tiers. Tiers 1 and 2 are the population tiers where primary care or even non-medical disciplines will come into play. And this is where I suppose mental and physical health integration is important. Right at the base, I mean, if you are going to ban social media, you're working at the base, right? It's very non-specific. Around this tiered care model, you need digital integration. What we have done in Singapore, and we've just started doing this in the last 5 years, we have created an ecosystem around a platform. Now, we tried it with physical health. So we had challenged our population to do steps. And as you know, that's a sign of physical activity. So our National Steps Challenge brought in about close to 2 million people, and they published on it. They've been able to get people to do those steps. Now, can we do this for mental health? What is the physical activity equivalent? Or is physical activity good enough as a universal intervention? Well, the platform is up. It's called MindLine. You can go onto this platform if you're interested. It's worldwideweb.mindline, MindLine.sg, right? MindLine has a resource, has multiple pieces to it. There is a platform for AI-assisted forum for young people. They have a chatbot, which is AI-assisted, called Wiser. Wiser is actually a chatbot that has been developed and used around the world. There's quite a lot of evidence based around it, its use. And it is essentially a signposting. Eventually, we hope that we'll put things that are intervention specific, like cognitive behavior therapy, on MindLine. But they represent what I would consider tier 1 and 2 activities. In tiers 3 and 4, we've developed with the Ministry of Health's Office of Healthcare Transformation this program called HOPES. HOPES is a health outcomes measurement. What it stands for is health outcomes through positive engagement and self-empowerment. It's actually a digital phenotyping or monitoring system. And that is in the works. We started with about 100 patients transdiagnostic across different diagnoses. We tried to help individuals monitor themselves with the help of their case managers and their caregiving families, parents, as well as their professionals like the psychiatrist and psychologist. If you do this tiered care with digital integration, you would be able to reach out to most people and accessibility would be much improved. So what about spiritual integration? Where does it come in? I think of spiritual integration actually around social media, because I think social media is a great place where you can put in elements of spirituality where people can access easily. So, in conclusion, what would the mental health ecosystem look like in 2050? Well, it would have physical and mental health integration. The hospitals need to be integrated, mind-body integration. There should be digital integration. Social media should not be seen as a bad thing necessarily. It should be part of digital mental health systems. And there should be some spiritual integration within the system. But of course, I shouldn't end by just telling you what the future should hold. What can you do now as individuals and organizations? Well, unlock our mindsets. You know, understand symptoms of body and brain, that it's not just a psychiatric syndrome, a physical illness. It's both. We know that they overlap a lot. To understand spiritual dimensions and not run away from them, embrace them. Reduce stigma through literacy. Support stress and mental health in physical illness, particularly in our hospitals today. And try to integrate services with community agencies. That's what I think we can do now. Thank you very much. We'll be right back.
From the Mental Health Services or Themes Conference, leading Singapore-based psychiatrist there, Dr. Daniel Fung, and you're with ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. My name is Natasha Mitchell. Now, how does the Singapore model of person-centred mental health care, combined with a very conscious use of digital media, resonate with the audience at this event? Barbara Disley, board member of the Themes Learning Network, facilitates the questions. And the first one is about the peer workforce in Daniel's hospital. So these are professionals with their own lived experience of mental illness. What does it look like?
I think, to be very honest, we started working on peers with lived experience back in 2010. I was the chairman of the Singapore Association for Mental Health. That's like our major, like the major secular mental health agency way back. It was started in the 60s by a group of psychiatrists, and I was chairman and president of the organization. And we said, look, you know, there's so much value that we can get from having peers. Following that, the National Council of Social Services, which coordinates all our social service agencies, decided to develop a training course that was national. And we've been training, I think now, several hundred peer support specialists. Many of them have gone into the agencies to work. We have 12 that work in our hospital. Our original goal was to get 40 into the hospital. And bear in mind, although I have a 2,000-bedded hospital, it is Singapore's smallest hospital in terms of workforce. I only have 2,500 staff. So 40 was a very, I thought, manageable goal. We still are looking for peers who are willing to work with us. And one of the problems is I don't have a good governance framework, which I saw in this conference, so I'm going to take that back with me. I'd like to be able to make sure that they are paid as well as our allied health. But we need to make sure that there is a proper framework for their pay, because in Singapore, it's kind of a new category. So today they sit in allied health services. Should that be a separate category to make sure that their remuneration is adequate and sufficient? That's one of our challenges. I think there's great value in bringing lived experience into our centres, but I don't have that ability to put one peer support specialist in every unit that I have. I have about 50 over departments in the hospital, and I only have 12.
What do you see lived experience knowledge can bring into the model that you've been talking about, and how does that link then through to people's understanding of their world?
Well, I think, as I've said, right, in the lived experience allows us to have a viewpoint, which is, you know, I use the word mental illness not without purpose. I don't say mental disorder. I don't say mental disease. Mental illness is personal. Everyone's illness is different. How many of you have got COVID before? All of you did. And if you turn around and ask your neighbor, how was it like? You're going to get different answers. So that lived experience is the personal reflection on these things. You can say, we need digital integration. How does the person with lived experience respond to it? Some of you will like it. I heard, you know, the person say, well, I want a face-to-face. I've got patients who say, please, Dr. Fung, I'd rather meet you online. I'm much more comfortable that way. So there you are. It's lived experience. The same thing with spirituality. Lived experience should bring that into the conversation. Doctors and nurses, psychologists, allied health, whoever is dealing with the individual to say then, well, let's talk about it. I'm always curious to know what the patient thinks about these things. But if you tell them, no, we can't talk about this, this is very personal to you, then it doesn't work. And sometimes they'll ask me, do you think you could pray for me? Or do you think you could help me in some way? And I often say, yeah, if you want me to, but this is my religion. If you want an expert, we could get someone in. So we need to be responsive to the individual as we look at these things. I'm giving you a concept, but how it plays out depends on that relationship that you have with the person.
What does the peer workforce look like in Singapore or within your hospital, and how do you find this discipline ties with salutogenic assets for health?
Okay, this is a question, and it sort of reflects a little bit
a thought I had, and it is there is now significant evidence that involvement in religion is actively harmful for the mental health of LGBTQI plus people. Higher rates of risk of suicide, etc. So how can we make religious spaces safe?
The problem is there is always a polarity in managing this issue. Now, as a Christian, LGBTQIA+, right? They are just people that we need to love. Everyone needs love. I've been advocating for inclusive work. As a Christian, I'm trying to write a book on gender dysphoria. But I feel it's important. And not because we should not isolate any groups. I mean, this is one. There are many other groups as well that we have to deal with that sometimes gets marginalized. Advocacy is not just about campaigning, but advocacy is also research and education. That's very powerful advocacy. We need to do the research around this area properly. You know, we've just published a local sort of a review on gender dysphoria of the patients that come to our clinics, because there is very little research that's done in this area. And sometimes it's, you know, people say you can't do research. Of course you can. Everything can do research, including spirituality issues and religion. So we need to do more research about the benefits. And then creating the safe spaces, I mean, that's very important, but that's also culturally acceptable. In Denmark, they have suicide clinics for suicide. You think, huh? But it's true. Why? Because the Danish people, they go to the priest only for three reasons. When they're born, and they get married, and when they die. So the suicide clinic, it's a good place. They go there, and you know who meets them in the suicide clinic? A priest. And it works for their culture. And Australia, like Singapore, very diverse cultures. We have to allow for this diversity and include everyone in how we practice. That includes spirituality and religion. So I want to include it. Religion is not saying that these kind of people are not accepted. They all need care and love. And then better still, if we can include families. You know, we've professionalized a lot of services today to the extent that we don't, sometimes we exclude families because they say, oh, this is the personal interest. But at least in Singapore, I still say, let's consider the views of the father, the mother, and even though this is an adult person, because the family is powerful. And we can't afford mental health services professionally across the board. We don't have enough resources engaged in families. If people said they can hear and see God, you know, there are some symptoms of mental illness that are obviously religious-based. But that very often, if it is a mental illness, it follows the mental illness syndrome. It's not difficult to identify this person as having a difficulty. If it is truly spiritual, they would act in a way that is logical and rational, even in that spiritual experience. And I will share this with you because that's one of the reasons why I became a psychiatrist. I met a psychiatrist who shared his personal experience of God, who told me, this is not bipolar disorder or anything of that sort, because I know this, but this is my personal experience. And it made a lot of sense. So even in spiritual matters, you can distinguish. And I don't profess to be a spiritual expert. If there's a spiritual issue, I usually refer to the experts, the professionals, the priest or pastor in our system. And we do have them in our systems, and we should have them. I know that you've integrated here in Australia and New Zealand some degree of that spiritual piece for the Aboriginal people, which is very good. What about the rest of you? You've got your original religions. Think about that. Thank you.
Dr. Daniel Fung, a psychiatrist and the CEO of the Institute of Mental Health in Singapore. He was speaking at the 2025 Mental Health Services Conference in Brisbane. And you also heard there from Barbara Disley, who is a board member of the Mental Health Services Learning Network. I'm Natasha Mitchell with ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. This is your front row seat to big thinkers at the best live events. Let's round off with Michael Gilding from the Big Ideas Archive. He wants us to better understand the mental health afflictions of depression and anxiety and the role that fear plays in these experiences. He's worked for 30 years as a psychotherapist in the UK, and he's really focusing on the way we breathe and how that shapes our body's response to fear.
So what happens in the body in the different fear responses? When we sense danger, but we don't know quite what it is, we usually keep very still so as not to be spotted and hold our breath to be able to hear better. Our heart rate rises and our hearing, eyesight and sense of smell become more acute so we can track the danger. Also, our startle response is heightened. There's two bits to this. First is that the signal in the nerves which control the muscles of the arms and legs is increased, so there's plenty of power to move off quickly. And the signal in the ventral vagus nerve is switched off. The body is in a volatile state where it's ready to go straight into the extreme action of fight and flight with nothing getting in the way. The main thing we notice in fear alert is holding our breath and our tension. Our thinking capacity is entirely focused on the potential threat, and we feel on edge and wary. The important thing about fear alert is that it saves energy. Fear arousal uses up a huge amount of energy. If prey animals such as antelopes went into full fear arousal every time there was the slightest hint of danger, they'd all be lying exhausted on the ground at the end of the day, and the predators would just need to stroll up and collect their food. So fear alert provides a checking out state where the body is readied for extreme life-saving action, but there's no big commitment of energy. So we can very quickly revert to a calm state. And that's a key point, because if we can look out for the sensations of fear alert in ourselves or in anyone we're trying to help, we can quickly get back to calm and avoid going into fear arousal, which could take the best part of an hour to recover from. All we might need is a slight movement of the body just to break the tension and a deep sigh, and we step back from fear alert. Moving on to fear arousal, I'll start with the response everyone has heard of, fight and flight. Once the danger is close, the brain's threat center, the amygdala, triggers a huge number of changes in the body through the release of hormones and via the sympathetic nervous system with the aim of surviving by running and fighting. An immediate release of adrenaline causes the heart rate to shoot up and the chambers of the heart to expand, which increases the volume of blood pumped with every heartbeat. When this happens, we can experience a sudden upward surge of energy with a heart pounding in the chest. You may be familiar with this if you can remember the last time you really lost your temper. A series of cortisol-based hormones are produced, which trigger the release of glucose and other nutrients into the bloodstream from storage cells throughout the body. The blood supply to the muscles is increased, and we are now hugely stronger and faster than we were a few seconds ago. The blood supply to the gut and other non-essential areas is shut down, so we might have a feeling of nausea. We might also break into a sweat, which is the body's mechanism which prevents overheating in this high energy state. We sometimes notice that our mouth goes dry. This is caused by the release of the hormone vasopressin, which acts to retain water in the body so that any blood loss through an injury can be replaced. And at the same time, the brain releases powerful painkillers so that the pain of injury doesn't get in the way of escape from danger. You'd all have heard accounts of soldiers in battle who can be shot or seriously wounded, and they don't even notice it till afterwards. That's how powerful the numbing effect of fear arousal can be. Finally, the amygdala shuts down a lot of activity in the cortex, the newest part of the brain. So our thinking ability is hijacked. We can only focus on danger, and we start viewing other people as a threat. But there are further stages to fear arousal. When we can't run or fight, we go into freeze like a rabbit in a car's headlights. Freeze is the fight-flight response put on hold. What happens in our body is exactly the same as fight-flight, but with no clear escape route, muscles lock and they're held in a rigid tension, which can then result in trembling. Because our alarm is not being channeled into action, I think this state feels far worse than fight flight. And the pounding heart is such a powerful sensation that many people experiencing this turn up at A&E departments fearing that they're having a heart attack. If an escape route presents itself, we can instantly switch back into fight or flight. But if there's no escape, our heart rate might peak in fright. This is the tipping point into fear collapse. Our mind goes blank, our legs go weak, and we start to feel faint. Fear collapse triggers when the fear arousal has failed and death seems imminent. The body goes into shutdown. So what's happening? It's triggered by the brain's threat center, the amygdala, and powerful painkillers are released into the bloodstream that induce drowsiness and numbness. The dorsal vagus nerve triggers a sudden drop in blood pressure by widening key blood vessels, which is also what happens in a faint. This means that all the cells of the body, the muscles, brain, gut, major organs, are starved of oxygen and nutrients. Now, the supply of oxygen and glucose is what enables every cell to produce the energy it needs to function, a process called cell respiration. When blood pressure drops and this supply is cut, every cell is de-energized, so there's a collapse of energy production throughout the whole body. It means that the muscles lose their tension and stop working. The newest part of the brain, the cortex, shuts down, which disables the control systems for thinking and for socializing. Then an older part of the brain, the limbic system, which controls our emotional responses, also shuts down. The full activation of fear collapse means that a prey animal suddenly collapses and appears to be dead. This starts us off thinking about what fear collapse feels like in the human body. We experience it as a downward drop in energy or a sinking feeling. So whenever we have a real sinking feeling, particularly a sudden one, it could well indicate fear collapse. We feel faint, our posture slumps, and our muscles feel heavy as lead. Our eyelids feel heavy and facial muscles droop. We can experience numbness, which dampens our emotional responses, along with a sense of unreality, a sense of being out of the body. We might feel nausea as the gut shuts down, and we might lose control of our bladder or bowels. As we descend into fear collapse, thinking slows down and eventually ceases entirely. Our ability and also our desire to be social is also gradually paralyzed. We lose the ability to make sense of the nonverbal cues, and we can also lose the ability to pick out the human voice from background noise, so we can't properly hear, process, or recall what's being said to us. And finally, we lose all emotional responses, including our sense of fear, and we move from feeling faint and lethargic into physical collapse. Those who have been involved in serious accidents or have suffered violent assault or rape will very likely have experienced a full fear collapse. I believe, however, that most of us are familiar with less extreme forms of this, and I'm going to be arguing that low mood and depression are experiences of fear collapse.
British psychotherapist Michael Gilding about taking control of your fears. He has a new book out in 2026 called Fear in the Therapy Room, a survival guide for working with complex trauma. And we'll put a link in the show notes for this episode to his whole lecture, which I know was a popular one with Big Ideas listeners. And speaking of your favourite Big Ideas episodes, as summer rolls on, we will be bringing you a month of your and our favourite events from the year on Big Ideas, a chance to listen again to big thinkers you've enjoyed, or to catch them for the first time if you missed them. And be sure to follow Big Ideas on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts, and take us with you on your summer road trip. Hey, I look forward to joining you on them. My name is Natasha Mitchell. Catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.